This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, the 10th of November, 2006. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Analysts indicate that a Democratic sweep won't necessarily translate into major changes for the war in Iraq. Texas death row inmates end their nearly month-long strike denouncing inhumane prison conditions. And it's been 11 years since Ken Saro-Wiwa was violently executed. We'll hear about Shell's new plans for Nigerian oil. All that and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Just 2 days after an Israeli attack in Gaza killed 18 civilians, the Palestinian prime minister has announced that he is willing to step down if his resignation would lead to the lifting of the economic embargo. Syed Benoura reports from Beit Sahur.
After meeting today with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh announced that the two have set aside their differences in an attempt to form an internationally recognized unity government. Despite the fact that the Palestinian elections in January were considered fair and unbiased, the Hamas-led government has not been recognized by either Israel or the United States. Today's announcement comes in the midst of ongoing Israeli attacks and restrictions of movement. Over 75 Palestinians have been killed since last week, one-third of them children. No Israelis have been killed or injured in that time. And the Israeli-imposed restrictions on Palestinians' movement has increased in conjunction with the Israeli invasions in Gaza. Dozens of new Israeli checkpoints have been set up, in addition to 600 already in place throughout the Palestinian West Bank. And people under 45 years old were prohibited from praying today at the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. For Afas Aran from IMEMC.org, this is Saed Banoura in Beit Sahur, Palestine.
A Colombian court has ordered the arrest of three congressmen for their alleged involvement with outlawed paramilitary groups. Mike Caesar reports from Bogota.
All three of the senators ordered arrested are from the province of Sucre on the Caribbean coast. One is accused of helping organize and finance paramilitary groups, as well as having responsibility for a massacre of 20 civilians in the year 2000. A second congressman is accused of membership in a paramilitary group, and a third of financing the illegal organizations. Courts are also investigating four more congressmen, also members of President Uribe's coalition. Much of the evidence against the congressman was obtained from a laptop computer captured from one of the most powerful and notorious paramilitary leaders, Rodrigo Tovar, known as Jorge Cuarenta. The computer records also detailed hundreds of political assassinations. The paramilitary groups are carrying out a demobilization, in which tens of thousands of fighters have turned in their weapons and are trying to return to normal society. But many observers say the groups continue dominating large regions of Colombia. For FSRN, I'm Mike Caesar, reporting from Bogota.
The last four defendants in the Pacific Northwest Green Scare case yesterday changed their pleas to guilty and agreed to drop their subpoena demanding NSA surveillance data on their indictments. Lisa Loving reports from Portland.
The defendants are part of a federal dragnet that captured more than a dozen radical environmentalists charged with arsons claimed by the Earth Liberation Front and the Animal Liberation Front. The case took an extreme turn when federal investigators threatened the defendants with Patriot Act terrorism charges. However, none were ever charged with terrorism. One defendant, Jeff Hoag, remains in jail. Northwest Constitutional Rights Center Director Alejandro Queral says this is the last remaining loose end in the case.
Basically, it resolves the Oregon cases. And so the big question that remains, and I think this is important for the community to understand and really get involved in trying to get Jeff Hoag out of prison. He's still being held in contempt for refusing to answer questions to a grand jury.
The arsons, which were set from 1999 to 2001, caused an estimated $30 million in damage, but no injuries. One defendant did die. Arizona bookstore owner William Rogers allegedly committed suicide in his jail cell on December 23, 2005. I'm Lisa Loving, reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Portland, Oregon.
A controversial bill in Peru's parliament could prevent journalists from practicing their profession for lack of a college degree. Pamela Cueva reports from Lima.
If passed, the legislation will particularly affect journalists who do not have a degree in communications. Critics of the measure say it would limit freedom of speech to established academics. The measure was presented by the ruling party during the last parliamentary session and recently received approval from the Education Committee of the current parliament. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights has come out against the measure, saying that the requirement of a degree for journalists to work in their profession violates the Human Rights Pact of San Jose, Costa Rica. Peru's Teachers Union also opposes the measure. The attempt to place additional requirements on journalists comes shortly after the passage of a law that places tight restrictions on the operations of non-governmental organizations in Peru. Many political observers say the measures effectively stifle criticism of administration of President Alan Garcia. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Pamela Cueva with Alfredo Cuadros from Lima, Peru.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The crop of newly elected officials will expand the representation of progressives. The newly elected Congress will likely add 8 new members to the Congressional Progressive Caucus. That's nearly a third of congressional Democrats. And 2 of the most liberal House members were just elected to the Senate. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell has more.
Jerry McNerney pulled off a major upset. He beat longtime powerful Republican Richard Pombo for California's 11th district. The two men couldn't be more different. McNerney ran on an eco-friendly platform, opposing the war in Iraq and for fair trade rather than free trade. Pombo, chair of the House Resources Committee, is pro-business and development. He was instrumental in altering the Endangered Species Act to allow for more development. He's also a proponent of opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge up for drilling. Environmentalists invested heavily in Pombo's defeat. Keith Ellison is the first Muslim to be elected to Congress. The African-American from Minnesota's 5th ran on a peace platform. And John Hall beat 6-time incumbent Sue Kelly in the 19th district in New York. And all candidates had a long list of progressives endorsing them. Tim Carpenter, executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, is one of them.
It's exciting to see, as people talk about the Democrats taking back the House, for us as progressives, it's not just Democrats that won, but progressive Democrats.
The Congressional Progressive Caucus endorsed 13 candidates this election. 8 of them won. If all 8 choose to join the Progressive Caucus, that will bring the membership to 71. 71 members who have pledged to support progressive values is a significant number to implement their agenda. Roger Hickey with Campaign for America's Future says that the progressives have become more prominent and have had an impact on the centrist Democrats.
Well, first of all, the election was a huge victory for progressives all over the country. And progressives taught most of these successful Democratic candidates how to campaign. We taught them how to campaign on the war and on corruption and on the connection between corruption and policies that hurt the middle class. And these were the issues that the successful campaigns ran on.
2 of the most progressive members of the House of Representatives were elected to the Senate. Sherrod Brown of Ohio, who founded the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and self-proclaimed socialist Bernard Sanders of Vermont. Again, Roger Hickey.
I think they'll have a really very good impact on what tends to be a very stodgy body, even among the Democrats. So I think it's going to be a shot in the arm for the Democrats in the Senate.
Since Tuesday's elections, Democratic leaders, Representative Nancy Pelosi and Senator Harry Reid, spoke about working with the Republicans. Pelosi met with President Bush yesterday and Reid did today, where they all pledged cooperation. But with an increase of progressives who often vote very differently than their Republican counterparts, is bipartisanship achievable? Roger Hickey says that since the Democrats are in control, it'll be up to the Republicans to go along with it.
Well, of course, having just won a major victory, it is smart for the Democrats to talk about bipartisanship, to hold that up as a standard that the Republican Party ought to be expected to behave. They should be changing their tune, given the drumming, the thumping that President Bush called it, that they just took. Whether the Republicans will rise to that invitation from Nancy Pelosi, I think is very questionable. They've become a more conservative minority party as a result of this election.
The Republicans have become more conservative because many of the moderate Republicans are the ones who lost their seats in swing districts. For instance, incumbent Nancy Johnson of Connecticut, a middle-of-the-road Republican, was beat by Democrat Chris Murphy. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
President Bush will still push for the confirmation of John Bolton to be ambassador to the United Nations. In a press briefing with reporters, White House Press Secretary Tony Snow said the president believes Bolton has been successful at the UN and deserves to be confirmed by the Senate. But Republican Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island said yesterday he will block Bolton from passing through both the Foreign Relations Committee and the Senate. Chafee said, quote, "The American people sent a clear message of dissatisfaction with the foreign policy approach of the Bush administration. To confirm Mr. Bolton to UN ambassador would fly in the face of the clear consensus this country is calling for," unquote. Senator Chafee, the most moderate member of the Senate who opposes the war in Iraq, just lost his seat to Democrat Sheldon Whitehouse. Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate and the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense will not necessarily mean major changes for the war in Iraq, analysts say. That's primarily because it's the president and not Congress that supervises the armed forces and runs the war, FSRN's Aaron Glantz reports.
Since the September 11th attacks 5 years ago, Congress has cast a series of votes authorizing $448 billion in funding for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. That's the main lever of control Congress has over the war in Iraq, meaning the Democrats could bring the war to a halt by refusing to fund it. That's how the Vietnam War ended, but at this point that doesn't seem likely. Even Democrats swept into Congress on a tide of anti-war sentiment talked gingerly around the idea of defunding the war. Jerry McNerney was just elected to Congress from a previously Republican district in San Francisco's suburbs.
Well, it's very important to give our troops the equipment they need for their own security. That would be highest priority. I'd like to find a way to defund our involvement in Iraq, that's for sure.
But would you vote against providing additional funds for the war as a congressman now that you're going to Washington?
Well, again, I think the security of our troops is our highest priority, and then to find a way to end that war that makes everyone more secure. So funding is the best way to go about that or not.
One area where Democrats may exercise their power is in oversight hearings over how U.S. tax dollars are spent in Iraq. The men likely to chair government oversight committees with subpoena power, Congressman Henry Waxman of California and Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, have both indicated they plan to play hardball with the administration. Prothap Chatterjee directs the nonprofit Corp Watch.
They can say, we want the head of Bechtel or the head of Parsons or the head of Halliburton to come and testify, and they'll have to do it because that's the way the law works.
Chatterjee says that doesn't mean that the war will end, but it does mean that we'll know more about how it's being fought.
Answers can be demanded from people at the top, and they can be forced to turn over internal documentation and things like that to the government that maybe you and I can't ask for. I've literally seen that happen.
Longtime anti-war activist and author Tom Hayden sees the Democratic victory this November as the beginning of a long process that will eventually bring the end of the war, probably after George Bush leaves office in 2008.
I think it's very helpful that the Democrats have found their voice in condemning the management of the war, but you don't have to be very intelligent to do that. Where the Democrats are traditionally and currently paralyzed, I think, is in what to do about it. They don't have that obligation yet because they're not going to take back presidency if they ever do for 2 years.
Hayden believes there will be an attempt by both parties to keep the war going and get rid of Iraq as a public issue. But he thinks the war will remain in front of people's minds anyway. In such an environment, he says, efforts to stymie military recruiting will become increasingly important.
There's several options. The one that I think is extremely important is opposing military recruiting at our high schools and community colleges. The keep the pressure on that the draft not be resumed. You have to have a military that's rested and fit and capable to fight a war. That's the key pillar, and the anti-recruiting efforts are the most important.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
With thousands of eligible voters being forced to vote provisionally, one race may still be too close to call. In Ohio's 15th congressional district, Democratic challenger Mary Joy Kilroy is launching an aggressive effort to ensure that all votes in Ohio are counted before she concedes the race to Republican incumbent Deborah Price. Allison Rahm reports.
Count those votes! Count those votes! Most locals describe the race for the 15th congressional district as bitter and ugly. Now, Mary Jo Kilroy's campaign to count every vote is adding more fuel to the fire, which has seen months of offensive TV ads and aggressive voter outreach. Deborah Price says she's the winner, with less than a 3,000-vote lead. Kilroy says the race isn't over yet.
Today we are here because we must count our votes. We must count all votes. I mean, in a democracy, one would think that would not even have to be a question, that all votes must be counted. And no election, and certainly not this one, should be considered over until that happens, until all votes are counted. And win or lose, that should be our mantra.
Kilroy says the Count Every Vote effort is about protecting democracy in Ohio. About 21,000 voters in Franklin County were forced to vote with a provisional ballot. 20,000 absentee ballots have yet to be counted. Several races and initiatives across Ohio have been decided by narrow margins. Almost 80% of the uncounted ballots in Ohio's 15th congressional district are from Franklin County, which is predominantly Democratic. Eileen Grinch says she registered to vote and received confirmation of her registration in the mail.
Well, when I showed up, I was told that I was tagged as a provisional voter, and I saw on the voting list that I was already pre-tagged, and there was really no reason. I asked them why. They said they couldn't tell me why I was provisional. It was kind of an iffy experience. I did vote in the end, but provisionally, and now I'm just worried about whether my vote was counted or not.
Yesterday at a rally for Kilroy, Grinch sought the advice of lawyers who were taking testimonies from those forced to vote provisionally. She says she intends to make sure her vote has been counted. New voter ID laws are partially responsible for the high number of provisional votes across the state. Edward Sauer worked at a polling station in a low-income area in Cleveland. He describes what he saw on election day.
Poor training, confusing ID requirement laws. We have these training booklets for the precinct officials, and there are no clear pages that really explain the ID thing. I definitely got the sense that from at least several locations, poll workers were turning people away that were on the list.
In the midst of uncertainty, one thing is for sure. Voters will have to wait until the Board of Elections certifies the vote on November 21st for this race to finally be put to rest. For Free Speech Radio News in Columbus, I'm Allison Rahm.
Today marks the 11-year anniversary of the execution of playwright and minority rights activist Ken Sarawiwa, who was killed along with eight others from his Ogoni ethnic tribe in Nigeria's Niger Delta region. The nine men were violently executed by the Nigerian military in the heat of their campaign against environmental pollution caused by the Anglo-Dutch oil company Royal Dutch Shell on Ogoni land. Sarawiwa's activities forced Shell to vacate Ogoni land 13 years ago, but now, with the support of the Nigerian government, Shell wants to resume oil production in the area. The Nigerian government says it wants to clean up the polluted land with the involvement of the United Nations, a move seen as the first step to Shell's return. But the Ogonis are questioning the sincerity of both the Nigerian government and the oil company. FSRN's Samuel Lokoya reports from Port Harcourt.
As they remember the executions carried out 11 years ago, the Ogonis are bitter that Sarawiwa and the other eight men were hanged in the course of a struggle to stop environmental pollution on their land. Baredon Banu is an Ogoni.
It is sad because the people that laid down their life, the Ogoni Matas, did not commit any sin for which they were hanged for. They were innocently killed. And that is why we are also here today, to tell the world that nothing has changed.
Even though Shell was forced out of Ogoni land 13 years ago, the people still continue to suffer environmental pollution from the company's installations. In one instance, in Barale village, crude oil, which was left leaking from an oil pipeline for 4 months, entered the homes of villagers. Young Aseme said his house and some others were burnt when the crude oil exploded.
There was a spillage. The oil entered inside my house. All everything were damaged by the spillage. The spillage catch fire 10 o'clock in the night. When we were in the house, we heard the sound of the spirit. Sound very massive, is boom, boom. All of us was, we shouted and packed our loot, some of our things lost.
Shell says its installations continue to pollute Ogoni land because the Ogonis don't grant its workers access to maintain them. During an appearance before a human rights panel in Nigeria's Niger Delta region, Egbert Imomo, who at the time was head of Shell in Nigeria, says the company, which is also known as SPDC in Nigeria, is prepared to clean up Ogoni land if granted access.
SPDC needs access to enter Ogoni, assess the conditions of all our facilities, and make them safe. SPDC needs to assess and clean up all oil spills that may have occurred in Ogoni, irrespective of the causes. There is a need for free, peaceful, and unfettered access for normal operations.
The Nigerian government has brought in a team from the United Nations Environment Programme to commence preliminary work on cleaning up the area. The cleanup is expected to be the first step towards Shell's return to Ogoni land. But the Movement for the Survival of Ogoni People, MOSOP, has rejected the cleanup exercise. The group, which Sarowa led before its execution, says the plan to return Shell to Ogoni land does not consider the interest of the people. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Port Harcourt.
A hunger strike on Texas death row ended this week after nearly a month-long effort to improve conditions prisoners say are inhumane. FSRN's Renee Feltz was there and spoke to some of the striking inmates.
I believe in America that we still should be treated with constitutional rights, and we have a right not to be tortured and abused until execution.
Stephen Moody was one of six men who began a hunger strike on October 8th to improve conditions on death row. After 22 days, the 49-year-old began eating again in order to avoid health complications. Another prisoner, Stephen Woods, refused meals for 26 days.
Right now, it's pretty much over.
Woods says he'll spend the next 6 months planning a larger hunger strike to press the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, or TDCJ, for changes.
As far as I heard, they will never allow any type of creep activity back here, so we've got to try to force them. And the only way I can think is to put, 20 to 50 people on a strike, get as many of us in the hospital as we can, wasting TDCJ's money.
Hunger strikes focused on improving conditions on Texas death row began occurring with greater frequency about 6 years ago. That's when the men lost their access to a day room and a work program. After an attempted escape, death row was moved to the higher security Polunsky unit, where men spend 23 hours a day in cells that are 60 square feet. They spend recreation time alone. Woods says prisoners now talk to each other by screaming at the walls.
We have these little bolts in some of the walls, and you can sit up there and lean against the wall and talking to it, to the person on the other side. I spent 12 hours when my buddy moved in next door to me, talking to the wall. It's crazy back there.
Prison officials say the solitary conditions are necessary to prevent men from planning another escape. Stephen Moody disagrees.
Everybody needs social contact, I believe, to function well.
Moody argues conditions on death row amount to sensory deprivation. He compares them to conditions in punitive administrative segregation units, where prisoners are sent if they violate rules.
And you go against TDCJ rules, they put you in punitive ad sec for a period of time. We come straight here.
Some of the hunger strike's demands focus on securing the same rights for death row prisoners that others in the general population have, like access to television.
A lot of these guys that's having trouble that's been here 7 years in this type of environment, the TV is not a non-essential item. It connects you to the world, to pop culture, to news.
Moody says isolation on death row causes some prisoners' mental health to deteriorate. TDCJ offers them psychotropic medication, but he argues returning social activity and TV access would be better solutions. Prison official Michelle Lyons says the new death row has no common area with a wall to suspend a television from so prisoners can watch from their cell. The day room is also designed differently.
They have a recreation area that's designed to let them get out, stretch their legs. They can interact with inmates in the other cells.
Death Row prisoners and their supporters petitioned the prison board to grant television access. To do so, Lyons says it would have to consider if TVs would go in individual cells and how much they would cost if prisoners could buy them from the commissary. Some of the prisoners' demands involve fundamental changes in policy. Again, Stephen Woods.
Contact visits, that's my main thing. I want to be able to hold my children, hug my mother. I want to just be treated like a human being.
For now, death row rules bar prisoners from touching loved ones until after their execution. Moody acknowledges prison officials could face public scrutiny for improving conditions, but he hopes the hunger strike will change that.
If they want to execute me, okay, I have come to terms with that. What I cannot come to terms with is that the public accepts me in a torturous environment. I don't believe if the public were educated to what's happening to us, I don't believe that most people would believe that we should be treated this way.
At the Polunsky Unit in Livingston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
On the four-year anniversary of a historic squad eviction in Toronto, Canada, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty held a demonstration to reclaim abandoned buildings for poor and homeless people in the city. CKUT's Aaron Lakoff reports from Toronto.
On Thursday evening, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, OCAP, led a housing rights demonstration of approximately 350 people through the poor neighborhood of Parkdale in Toronto, Canada's largest city. Amongst their demands was a Toronto-wide use-it-or-lose-it bylaw that would see unused private buildings turned into social housing for the poor. OCAP members estimate there are over 50,000 homeless people in the city. On Monday, Toronto residents will go to the polls for a mayoral election. Current Mayor David Miller is poised to be re-elected, with 55% support. This demonstration was timed to raise the issue of housing during the campaign period. Gaetan Haru is with OCAP.
The housing issue is not there. It's not part of the election. There's a lot of verbal promises. Miller has always said that the city is going to build 1,000 units per year for the last 2 years, claiming that he's housed 863 people in the streets of homes. But we know that the city is just not building housing.
The march made its way to the former site of the Pope Squat, a building taken over by OCAP during a visit to Toronto by Pope Jean-Paul II in the summer of 2002. Since the squat's eviction in November 2002, the building has sat empty. Agata Mrzowski is an OCAP organizer and community worker in Toronto.
There's abandoned buildings that are sitting empty while people are still on the street and don't have a place to stay. So we're coming back and we're saying, we're going to keep on taking housing. If you're not going to build it, we're going to take it. And also push the city to convert unused buildings into decent, affordable housing for people living in poverty.
After police blocked the entry to the former Pope Squat building, protesters continued on school buses to the wealthy Toronto area of Hyde Park, where they took over another abandoned building for just over an hour before leaving. The protests ended in front of Mayor Miller's house in Hyde Park, stating that no matter what the outcome of the elections on Monday, the new mayor will be held accountable to provide housing for the city's poorest. For Free Speech Radio News, this is CKUT's Aaron Lakoff reporting from Toronto, Canada.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, an independent, listener-supported newscast produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can listen to this newscast in its entirety online at www.fsrn.org. We welcome your comments, questions, and story ideas. Just email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Mara Bogado.